The school introduction. Okay, this is work I'm going to, that I did in collaboration, or is still being done in collaboration with Gabriel Cardozo, Jeff Kepley, and Thomas Mohart. And just to explain my title, by the word BPS, I mean, on the one hand, that I'm describing extremal black holes, and on the second hand, that I'm describing this in the context of supersymmetry, and in particular, an n equal 2 and n equal 4 supersymmetry. Since the observation by Stollinger and Waffa that there is a matching between the string and theory microstate counting, which leads to an entropy, which I will call henceforth the microscopic entropy, and the fact that when you go to the corresponding field theory solutions, the black hole solutions, and you calculate the area, which leads to, through the area law, to an entropy, which I call the macroscopic entropy, something, okay, and there is a precise match in many cases, in certain limits, usually in the limits of large charges. Here, of course, you rely on the area law, because we really calculate the area here, and we assume that the macroscopic entropy is given by a quarter of the area in Planck units, a fact which is associated with the first law of black hole mechanics. Now, I will mainly approach the subject from the macroscopic side, and so I'll start with briefly reviewing some characteristics of the black hole solutions that we are talking about. First of all, these black hole solutions are solitonic interpolations between, at spatial infinity, flat Minkowski spacetime. I'm talking now about n equal to 2 supergravity, but this is generically the case. And at the horizon, there is an ADS2 cos S2 space. And both these asymptotic, or said boundary spaces, have n equal to 2 supersymmetry. And in this case, that doesn't have deep consequences, but here it has, because this configuration is essentially unique. Then globally, these solutions are BPS. That means that globally, they have an n equal 1 supersymmetry. They're invariant on the n equal 1 supersymmetry. And a very crucial feature, which is indispensable for almost everything that is done here, is the so-called attractor mechanism, where at the horizon, the moduli are fixed in terms of the charges, whereas at spatial infinity, the moduli are just three integration constants, which of course affect the black hole mass, but they have nothing to do with what happens at the horizon. Well, not nothing. I mean, there is of course a differential equation that relates them. But this is of course indispensable because the things that the entropies that we get from microstate counting are functions of the charges and not functions of charges and moduli. You have no idea what the moduli are. So if this was not the case, then this would have been, I think, was probably have been the end of this subject, at least in this particular context. Now, some more details about this situation is that in n equal to 2 supergravity, and vector multiplets are encoded in holomorphic homogeneous functions of second degree, and it's subject to electromagnetic duality. This is the Wilsonian theory, and there are periods, according to special geometry, which you find from taking the scalars of the vector multiplets and the derivative of the function f with respect to these scalars, and they rotate under symplectic transformations, equivalent classes, which is associated with electric magnetic duality. Meaning that if you rotate the charges and you also perform this rotation here, then the theory takes the same form. It's sort of, well, yeah, it defines an equivalence class. Now, the word periods, of course, come from the Carabial context, because you know that all this is nicely matched by the way you can describe Carabial manifolds, but it's, in this context, it's more general than that. Now, in this talk, I will, since the xi are going to be projective coordinates, I have a certain freedom to rescale the axis, so I call them from now on y, and the rescaling I will not discuss here, but it is a very convenient rescaling, because it gets rid of lots of details and all sorts of constants that at some point you have to determine, and you will not see these constants here. So the attractor equations then, as was proven by the people I quoted on the previous transparency, Kalisch, Stollinger, and Ferrara take this particular form, and this particular form, you can see it right away, is consistent with electromagnetic duality because the X and the F define a symplectic vector, and the same, the P's and the Q's do the same thing. And if you calculate the area for generic black holes in this theory, characterized by this holomorphic function, then you find z squared is the radius, and z squared, it doesn't look like it's positive here. It is certainly, with these conditions, it's real. So there is a matter of, you have to make a choice for where you, how you define your moduli, etc. And then you get that the z squared is precisely equal to the holomorphic BPS mass, this particular combination. Now, since this f was a holomorphic function, this thing scales with 1, just like the axis, which is good because they have to be able to rotate. And since if you scale the p's and the q's accordingly, you can immediately see from this formula that the area goes over gn, or over in Planck units, goes like the square of the charges. And generically, what you usually find is a square root of some homogeneous polynomial of the fourth order polynomial of the charges. Now, just to give you an example, because it is important later on, if you take this particular example, if you take a Calabi-Yau threefold and you take an S1 in 11 dimensions in M-theory, and you wrap the 5-grain over a 4-cycle in a certain way, then there are two forms in the Calabi-Yau which have wrapping numbers PA, which take the form of magnetic charges in the field theory. The gauge fields that couple to that are the free index gauge fields from the 11-dimensional theory, which is precisely the same two-form structure. And the momentum S1, you give it the momentum Q0, and the gauge field here is the Kaluza-Klein photon. So from this microscopic picture, you sort of know what the theory is that you have to look at in the macroscopic domain, and you have to take this particular holomorphic function. You see it's homogeneous of second degree. This is the intersection number of the Calabi-Yau of the fourfolds. You calculate the area according to this recipe. You solve the moduli in terms of the charges. So you get the macroscopic entropy is equal to pi times this quantity z squared, which is this. You put it all on, and you get this particular expression here. There is quite a subtlety here which comes out of this macroscopic picture, but also can be understood microscopically, and that is this Q naught eventually is going to be replaced by a quantity which is called Q hat, and which has corrections due to the electric charges with the indices A, and that is the Mollefsena-Strominger-Witten effect, which is related to membrane interactions for this free form, but I will not enter that discussion here. Now, when the attractor equations were first set up and proposed, then it was always said that they sort of extremized the central charge. And there have been some discussions about this in the terms of a variational principle. And the variational principle, after that, not too much happened to it, but it's coming back now, and you'll see at the end of my talk that it has a certain role to play. And one particular form of the variational principle was put forward by Burns, Cardozo, Kalosh, Lust, Mohaupt, and myself. And that is, you take the following function here, which I call sigma, which is a combination of these three terms. This is sort of like the Kähler potential, or the Kähler potential for rigidly invariant supersymmetric Young-Mills theory. This is the quantity W, is the holomorphic BPS mass that I already mentioned before. That is the central charge that you get when you take rigid vector multiplets in the supersymmetry algebra. And you combine these three things, and now you take the variation, let me first say this, all these functions are invariant under these symplectic transformations of associated with electric magnetic duality, so they make a lot of sense. The Kähler potential is, you see, it's always a contraction of either the periods or the period with the charges, and that's why it's symplectically invariant. So it's a scalar function. And now you take the variation of this thing here, and then it reorganizes itself in this particular form. So you immediately see that if you make this stationary, then you get immediately the attractor equation. This is the magnetic attractor equation, and this is the electric attractor equation. And if you then calculate the sigma on the attractor, then you find that it is precisely this macroscopic entropy formula that we had before, up to a factor of pi. Now this will come back in a moment, will have some role to play, but before going into that I will discuss some of the possible corrections to this formula. And there are, as far as I know, there are sort of two corrections. I mean, first of all, you can take a function which is more complicated. I'm talking about, I call it corrections because they will lead to subleading corrections in the charges. And one of them, in the context of the Calabi-Yau example that I gave before, is associated with the second Chern class. Remember that this theory has four cycles, so there's a second Chern class associated with it. And there is another class of corrections which are non-Mersonian and which are non-holomorphic. So, but let me first go into this first class here. So you may wonder how you can get subleading corrections, because the formalism that I showed you is really homogeneous. Everything seems to scale uniformly, and it doesn't seem that you can get corrections which go like one of, so the leading correction, the leading term is q squared, and then you would expect to have something proportional to q, but it doesn't seem to be embedded in, it doesn't seem to have a place in the formalism. So how do you break the homogeneity? And that is that you can have an extra chiral multiplier in the theory. The vector multiplets, the field strengths define chiral multiplets. And in this holomorphic function, which is, if you write it in superspace, it's an holomorphic function of chiral fields. And but there is one extra field in the game which is also chiral, which you can use. And that is a thing that I'm going to call epsilon, which is really constructed from the what is sometimes called, although it's a very bad name, the gravity-photon field strength. This is an auxiliary field in the conformal sector of the supergravity theory. This has a scale with weight 2, which is a scalar. And if you construct this thing, it's just in the supergravity field, then you find that the attractive value of this particular field is not given by the charges, but it is equal to a number. It's equal to a number because I have done this secret rescaling, which I didn't explain to you, and then everything is just simply a number. And the number is minus 64. And it's independent of the charges, and that is quite reasonable because the supergravity fields themselves don't feel the electric and magnetic charges. So what you have to do then is you can just apply the standard techniques and you can take a holomorphic homogeneous function, but now you take this function which depends on the y's. The y's are associated with the vector multiplets, but also with this epsilon. And you require that it is holomorphic, which it is, and you require that it is homogeneous. And you, the only thing you have to know is that the weight of this epsilon is a factor of 2 larger than that of the y's. If you just put this in, then you can just use the whole tensor calculus as it was established long ago, and then you find that a new action, but you can immediately understand that it leads to something very new, namely the epsilon dependence in this function v to r squared turns proportional to the Riemann tensor squared. And the reason is that, of course, this t is coming from the supergravity multiplet. And if you vary it a number of times, you get the Riemann tensor and you get it squared because this thing is squared. Yes? Supersymmetry. You see, the attractor equation is just the expression of the fact that at the horizon you have full supersymmetry. So for, in principle, for every multiplet, whatever it is, you can determine what the requirements are of supersymmetry when you move towards the horizon. Okay? That is not in the chiral sector anymore. I mean, there are, of course, in principle, higher order curvature corrections, but then you have to move out of the chiral sector, and it will not be encoded in this particular function, because this is typically what people call the F terms. Then you have to go to D terms. And nobody has done that in this context. So, having this epsilon dependency, first of all, it allows you to understand, well, how you can ever get subleading corrections, and secondly, you understand that it immediately leads to an effective action which has R squared terms. With R squared, of course, with terms in front of this which depend on the moduli. And there is a generalized entropy formula which is different from the one before, which was proposed by Cardozo, Mohawk and myself in 98, where you see there is the area, and of course the area is affected now. Remember that Z depends on the holomorphic function. So the fact that there is an R squared interaction changes the value, but in any case, whatever that value is, I call it, it's the area in this particular case. But in addition, there is an extra term here. And epsilon has to be put equal to its attractive value here. Now, obviously, this violates the area law. And how did we get this? We got this because we had to use a different definition of the entropy. We had to use Wolff's definition of the entropy based on the conserved Neufeld charge. And the reason why you have to do that, well, first of all, we needed it to get agreement, but the reason you have to do that is because you want to ensure that the validity of the first law and the standard one that is based, say, on the area law doesn't violate the first law as soon as you have R squared terms. So don't think, by the way, that it's the R squared terms which generate this correction. The correction is really generated by terms elsewhere in the supersymmetric completion of the action. The R squared terms itself doesn't play a direct role in the calculation. And the question is now, given the title of my talk, is there, again, a variational principle? And surprisingly enough, there is. I'll just show you the previous transparency. And the only thing you have to add to that transparency is this term, and everything remains true. The green term that you see here, that's all you have to add, and you can do exactly the same form, and you get exactly the same. This macroscopic entropy now has the corrections due to the R squared terms. So there seems to be something behind this variational principle, and I will explain you what it is and what its consequences are. Yes? No. Yeah, it's defined at the horizon. Everything is done at the horizon. That's why it's pure algebra to calculate all these things, and the global solution, say, of the black hole solution doesn't really play a role. Yes? No, it's not so simple, because there are also corrections where the gravity-photon field couples to R. You see, there are many terms. And there is no idea of figuring out immediately by just looking at the formula what the relevant term is, because remember that when you move to the horizon, there is supersymmetry. And many terms which are generically there are equal to zero because of the supersymmetry. And the actual term which gives this contribution happens to be a term proportional to the gravity-photon field strength squared times R. Sure, the Wolff formula is completely a general formula. But when you move to the horizon and you have a special configuration, certain terms may cancel. And that's what happens in this case. Well, at this level, I'm not talking about alpha prime and g-string. That is the interpretation that you put on it. I mean, there is, of course, the Newton coupling constant, which I scale out completely. So everything is algebraic at this point. And remember that numbers don't mean that much. I mean, you can, of course, identify what the alpha prime correction is and so on. But numbers at some point, you know, whether it's 2 or 5 or something, doesn't matter too much. Because when you move to the horizon, the theory adjusts itself so that it acquires the supersymmetric configuration. And so whatever the number is, it will sort of compensate for that. So your feeling about large and small is very misleading. So in fact, you have to go to the effective action, and then you say, you know, do you know exactly where the terms come from, because you have a motivation from an underlying theory like string theory, and then you know what it is.
In string theory, it would be compressed by additional powers of both alpha prime and g-string. Is that right?
Yeah, it's somewhere in the effective action, but again, when you use the word suppressed, you have to be careful, sure. because certain things are going to blow up and do certain things.
I just wanted to check that it was not just alpha prime.
Uh-huh, yeah. Yes? Yes. Yes. That's certainly true. Yes. So here is the example, which at that time motivated our work. Namely, you take this function here and you add a term proportion to epsilon times this particular combination of the moduli, and these numbers come from the second term class on the Calabi-Yau. and you work this through, and you use the formula that I described before, and then you get a very nice and systematic result, where this thing is indeed subleading, because it's, you see, it's because of that thing, which has a certain scale, and this is exactly the microscopic result found by Mollison, Astrominger, Witten for microstate counting, and it is the and the macroscopic result was found by us, and there is exact agreement at this level. Now there was one, as I told you, this the area law was violated, and it is of interest to look how it is exactly violated in this particular model, say. So here you have one quarter of the area, and here you have the macroscopic entropy, and you see that there is this ratio, this factor. And there is something funny here, something intriguing, that in the microstate counting, this is precisely the ratio of the right and the left moving central charge of the conformal field theory. And I have no idea why that is so. But it happens where the right moving charge is the supersymmetric sector. And so this number here, depending on what this is, measures the violations of the entropy of the area law. Now, another example which is very interesting is the heterotic example. And the heterotic example is interesting for many reasons. First of all, there is a correspondence with the n equal 4 perturbative spring states. So you see, in order to have interesting examples, you have to take an example which is somehow related to an interesting configuration from the point of view of microstate counting. And we also can determine here the non-holomorphic corrections. And furthermore, there is a dynamic degeneracy formula which was proposed by Dijkgra, Verlinde, Verlinde in 1996. So there are a number of things that you can relate it to. Yes? In n equal to 4, I think they all, well, yes. With this limitation of r squared and so on. So this is a good laboratory to look at. So let's have a look at the heterotic black hole, where for the moment I'm still in n equal to 2, and the lowest order function is this particular function here, where this thing is going to build up the dilaton, and these are the T moduli. And if you work this out in lowest order and you look at the target space of the supergravity theory, then you find that it's a sigma model, which is and the target space is a product of two spaces, one associated with the dilaton and the other one associated with the T moduli. And when you extend this, so you can calculate it, and then you can say, look, this is really an approximation to an n equal to 4 theory, I just put some things equal to 0, then this factor here will be extended to the SO622, associated with 22 vector multiplets and n equal 4 coupled to supergravity. If you now follow the recipe and through the area law, so you calculate this, then you find that this is then the macroscopic entropy, which depends on the charges. You see that's again a four-order polynomial of the electric and magnetic charges. And this is both T and S invariant. Every product here, Q squared and P squared and Q dot T, is T invariant, so T duality will not really play a role in what I have to say. And this particular combination is S duality invariant. P squared and Q squared are not positive definite. There's a non-positive definite inner product. And you have to be careful because I did something with the charges. I had to rotate an electric and a magnetic charge in order to get it in the T-dual form. But this is not something that I'm going to discuss in any detail. So this is the formula. And the interesting thing in n equal 4, when you look at this from an n equal to 4 point of view, so we simply assume that this is the approximation or this is the truncation of the full formula in n equal 4. That means that I have put some of the charges possibly to 0, but it's still the same formula. The interesting thing in n equal to 4 is that there are two types of BPS states. This is very crucial. There are quarter BPS states which are truly dyonic, and they satisfy this condition here, where this is larger than 0. By the way, in the large charge limit, Q squared and P squared become negative, very negative, but still they have to satisfy this constraint. The one-half BPS states, which is I call electric, meaning that up to a magnetic, electric-magnetic duality transformation, they can be purely electric, and that satisfies the condition that this is equal to 0. And you see that this has a profound effect in this discussion, because if this is 0, then it means that the classical entropy or the classical area is equal to 0, something that was well known before this whole thing started. Now, obviously there are going to be corrections in the spirit of what I discussed before, and the corrections, whatever these corrections are, whether they are non-holomorphic or whether they are partly, some of them may be holomorphic, they will affect as duality. And the conclusion that we reached at that time was that you have to go really beyond the Wilsonian action. And that is nothing new. It is known that the physical symmetries of the theory are sometimes not realizable in the Wilsonian context, and you have to add the non-holomorphic corrections in order to have the symmetry. So either you have holomorphicity and no complete symmetry, or you have the full symmetry, but then you have to give up holomorphicity. And this is related to the holomorphic anomaly, the one that you know, for instance, from topological string theory. Now, so what you can do in first approximation is if you try to see if you can do this in the Wilsonian framework, you have to do the following. You try to check whether the invariance of the Wilsonian action under some transformation of the moduli, so the y goes in some way, either changed into new y's, which are a function of the old y's, then that implies that the changes of the y's, which are induced on the periods, on the y's, defined it here, but also on the fy, so you substitute this into that, must induce a symplectic transformation on these periods. And that symplectic transformation is the same one that will also be realized on the charges. If that is the case, then the theory is invariant, and otherwise it's not. So when you introduce a correction, and there is a good reason why you introduce this correction, because an n equal to 4 has at the same time the advantage that many of the corrections are explicitly known. And in this case, it's known that you only have a term which is linear in epsilon and which only depends on the dilaton field. So I change this function by an extra term proportional to epsilon, so I will have r squared terms eventually, and then some unknown function at the moment of the dilaton field, which is this particular combination here. Now, the s-duality transformations are here. They follow since, you see, the y's transform into y's and the derivatives, so it's sort of a symplectic transformation. This comes from the lowest order result. And now you use, and that means that the dilaton transforms as here in the usual way. A, B, C, and D are integers satisfying that, so that they define an SL to Z. And now you substitute these into the derivatives of the function, and you see whether they generate something that is, again, a symplectic transformation. And you see that they almost do, because this is, again, a linear in F in Y, F and F, but there is an extra piece here. And that piece depends on the derivative of F prime, because this is a derivative, so F doesn't show up, but it's the derivative that shows up here. So if this delta were zero, then there is a symplectic transformation, and it would be an invariance of the Wilsonian action. If it's not equal to zero, then of course you can see and try to find another F, or change your function, the capital F here, in such a way that at the end of the day, it is an invariance of your theory, so that the deltas become equal to zero. Now, in this particular case, F prime has to be a modular function of degree 2 of S. That is the condition. If that is the case, then these deltas are equal to zero. Unfortunately, there is no modular function of degree 2 which is consistent and which is holomorphic. You have to choose, if you want to remain for consistency with string perturbation theory, the only solution that you have for this function is a non-holomorphic function. So what we did at that time is then we said, well, then obviously these things will be have non-holomorphic corrections, and we'll simply close our eyes. We don't have a theory, but we'll just allow the f's to depend on the non-holomorphic terms, and this is a way of expressing what we found at that time. So you see that this is nice and holomorphic, the lowest order result, then there are the eta functions, and then there is an extra term which is neither holomorphic in epsilon and it's not holomorphic in S. Nevertheless, you simply use the same rules as before, and you write down the entropy. And then the result that you get has the following form. So this is the macroscopic entropy calculated in that way, but keeping S general for the moment. I have not imposed the last attractor equations which will fix S at the horizon, and I get this particular expression which looks very as duality invariant than it is. Now, the attractor equations now turn out to be just, this is something we didn't realize at the time, we only realized this last year, that the remaining attractor equations, which tell you what S is at the horizon, are just the condition that this thing is stationary with respect to changes of S. In other words, there is a variational principle here at work. And this variational principle is in fact a reduced version of the variational principle that I discussed before. I'll not go into the details, but when we first noted this, we didn't realize that, but now we realize where it comes from. There is also a normalization, you see, in this function f that I wrote down, the little f that I wrote down. It works for every value of that normalization, and that normalization is fixed by two ways. Either you used type 2 heterotic duality, spring duality, and then you find what the normalization is. Another thing that you can do, you can look at the asymptotic degeneracy of the 1/2 BPS states, and then you also get the same constant. Yes?
So you're saying the variation of this entropy gives just the last remaining attractor equation?
Yes. Yeah, these are two equations, because S is complex, of course. And once you put that in, then you have the entropy.
The other attractor equations have already been
imposed. The other ones have already been imposed, yes. So then, last year, we considered, we went back to this formula by Dijkgraaf-Verlinde, who wrote down that it's not really a microscopic formula in the sense that they didn't derive it from a particular configuration of brains and counted, and they sort of conjectured the formula by constructing something which satisfied a number of extremely reasonable criteria, which had to be S-duality invariant. And what they found is, what they proposed is a formula for the degeneracies of the dions. It is an integral over a free cycle, and it's an integral over the period matrix of a genus 2 Riemann surface. There is an exponent here. These are the charges, the electric and magnetic charges, which are sandwiched with this period matrix, the period matrix of the Riemann surface, and then there is an automorphic function of degree 10, which is the square of the cusp form, which is a function of degree 5, the Seekl cusp form. Now, formally, if you look at this expression and you just use that fact that you know that this is an automorphic function, then you can prove that this is an S-duality invariant function. And of course, that is what motivated their proposal. That was the leading principle in a way. Now, what we did last December is that we did a saddle point approximation of this formula. That was also done at the time by Dijkgraaf-Verlinde, but they only kept the leading terms, and they showed that this formula was consistent with the area law. So the first leading contribution in this formula is just the area law. But we went beyond that and we kept all the terms. And then when we had done that, and we had done this saddle point approximation, then in the limit of large charges, so up to terms which go like 1 over the charges, we found that the result of the saddle point approximation is precisely what I wrote on the top of the transparency. All these factors and everything came out, the attractor equations came out in the same way, and in fact that's the way how we discovered that the attractor equations were just associated with a variational principle. So, both of these things obviously have to be right, and that is an important confirmation of the fact that we are doing the right things here. Now, the 1/2 BPS states are different, and they have lots of problems, because a lot of things are not working as you would expect. And everything has to do with the fact that the leading contribution is equal to 0 in this case. You see, if the leading contribution is not 0, so if the classical entropy is not 0, then things apparently are safe, but once that is no longer true, then the subleading corrections become the leading corrections. And that is why the entropy, that is for instance why the macroscopic entropy is only 1/2 of the area, that's related to this ratio of the two constants that I gave. And as soon as this was noted, there was a whole, since August or September or so of last year, there have been quite a number of papers investigating issues related to this fact. Now if you take the equations that I wrote down at the top of the transparency, then you can simply solve them, and you can solve them in the limit of leading charges. And there is only one charge now, that is this Q squared, all the other charges are equal to 0 if you take everything purely electric. And then the real part of the dilaton, but the dilaton is actually real, there is no imaginary part, goes proportional to the square root of the charges, And that means that you are at weak string coupling. And if you look at the macroscopic entropy, then you get this 4 pi with a certain normalization. That is the normalization that I put in when I put in these corrections. And then there's a logarithmic term. And that can be compared to which we know from perturbative string theory, where the degeneracy is given by this integral in terms of the Dedekind eta function. And if you expand that, you see this formula is sort of a simplified version of the formula of Dijkgraaf, Verlinde, Verlinde, and that's no coincidence because they took this formula here and they generalized it into their formula requiring as duality invariance. So if you work this out, then you get exactly the same normalization, but here you get a different coefficient, so there's a discrepancy with the previous result. And I get the same normalization, but that is really because that I use that to fix the constant, but I want to stress that that is also in agreement and with the string-string duality argument that leads to the same prediction. So the question is now, if you have these, you see, we're now leaving the domain where we have complete control of the theory. Everything when it's holomorphic, then you really know what you're talking about. You have an action, and you're talking in some sense about solutions to that action. You're just constructing solutions, and the nice thing about it is that you're only looking at the part which is relevant at the horizon, so it looks like you're just doing simple algebra. Well, it's not always that simple, but basically that's what you're doing. But once you have the non-holomorphic terms, there is no corresponding action principle, so these terms are different. They don't fit into the framework, and there are lots of questions that you have to answer. So it's a valid question to see whether the non-holomorphic fractions can be incorporated in the variational principle, and they can, surprisingly enough. And what you have to do is you have to change your periods, the fi, the derivatives of fi, by a derivative of some real homogeneous function, and you have to change f epsilon, this is the first derivative with respect to epsilon, with this derivative, and you just put that in, and I'm not going to do it for you, and in this particular case you can, for instance, use this omega, where you see the holomorphic corrections. You see, if as soon as omega is the difference of two holomorphic, the imaginary part of an holomorphic function, then you can just absorb it into the fi. So this part here you can absorb into the fi's and into the function f, because it's the difference of, it's the imaginary part of an holomorphic function. But this, the last part here is a non-holomorphic piece which you cannot absorb into the holomorphic periods. And then you're stuck, but nevertheless it works. In a way it would be nice if it didn't work, because then at least there would have been some distinction. But at this point the theory seems to be flexible enough to absorb this particular correction. So when you work this out and you do exactly the same thing, you make this substitution in this function sigma that I wrote down, then you get in variational principle and you get the correct attractor equations. In this case, correct meaning that the attractor equations are S duality invariant. And that is sort of the construction backwards of what we did at that time. So let us return now to the variational principle and see what we can do with it. So generically, whether you have holomorphic corrections or not, or whether you have these quadratic, these R-square terms or not, you always have this quantity sigma that you can find, whose variation can be written in this form. When there are non-holomorphic corrections, this thing is sort of dressed up according to what I wrote here, but that is consistent with S-duality. So this always applies, and in particular, it also applies when you make a consistent reduction. You can always impose part of the stationarity conditions in the variational principle, assuming that if you check that it is consistent, meaning that, for instance, if you put this thing equal to zero, if you impose already these equations, then you have to check that this particular thing, so then you're safe. But you could be imposing something on the fields in such a way that certain terms in the attractor equation are not automatically equal to zero, and so you get inconsistent terms. But in this case, that is okay. It would not be okay if you would take some of these guys and you would take them to zero, because then some of these variations would still not be zero automatically. Now, if you take the magnetic reduction, you take this rule here, so that means that you write the y's in this particular way, where this is the magnetic charge and this is the real part of y, then everything is consistent. You have a function, and the only thing which is important is the real part of the wires, as you can see from here. And if you work that out, then you get the following setting, that pi times sigma is equal to a function f, which is the imaginary part, proportional to the imaginary part of f, and you get q times phi, but q is equal, is related to the imaginary, the derivative of the imaginary part of f, which you can see here. You see, if you take the variation with respect to f, then its derivative is the imaginary part of this function, the imaginary part, and that is the charge. Now, this is precisely what was proposed by Uguri, Stolmacher, and Doffa last year. And I think the observation here is that this is sort of part of a bigger, of a slightly more general variational principle, and this is just a specific case of that. And in the same way, the case that I discussed where we had to the variational principle with respect to the dilaton field, that is a further reduction of the same variational principle. And that observation is going to be very useful in a minute, but let me first complete what Waffa, Oguri, Stolmacher, Waffa, what they conjectured at that time. They said, well, I forgot to say one thing. This thing takes the form of a Legendre transform here. Where is it? Here. So this is going to be the entropy when you oppose the attractor equation, and this is the function f, which is a function of phi and p, and then here there is a term which is just like a Legendre transform, so q and phi are subject to a Legendre transform. And given the fact that it's a Legendre transform, it is suggested that this is some kind of free energy, so that e to the power f is some partition function. And that partition function depends on phi, and phi is the electrostatic field at the horizon, and the magnetic charge p. Now, once you write on that, then if you have such a partition function, which is a mixed partition function because you treat p's and q's or p and phi's differently, then you realize that this has to be something like the sum over all the possible charges. In principle, you don't know what the charge lattice is, of course, in this in general. Then there are here the microscopic degeneracies, and then here there is the e to the q phi. That is sort of suggested. So. And then the interesting thing is that if you look at this e to the phi, since f was the imaginary part of this function, this is in the case without the holomorphic corrections, then this thing here can be written as the square of e to the power minus 2 pi I f, and this thing here is precisely the topological string partition function up to certain normalizations that you can discuss. Now, this is not something that I'm going to discuss, but of course it's in the back. This is in the background, because this relationship is extremely important if it is true. But you can also take the inverse if you have this function here, and you can write a Laplace transform now of the microscopic degeneracy just by inverting this formula and integrating over the d phi times this function here, the function that you started with. Now, why this function here is then, if you want to use topological string input, you can put it in here, and in principle then you can obtain something. You can obtain the microscopic degeneracies out of a macroscopic formula. So this is extremely exciting, and let me remind you that this f minus q phi is nothing else than the sigma, which has been, where we have imposed part of the attractor equations. We could also go, you know, not impose these attractor equations, but some of the other ones. And this formula has been tested, or people have been worrying about it, and in particular there's a long paper now which came out in February, I think, and was a revised version in April, by de Volker, de Neff, Moore, and Piolin, where they look at this, and the question is whether this proposal makes sense, and how you can test this proposal. And there is obviously something that doesn't make sense. First of all, this thing is not automatically well defined. When you look at it, even when you have an Gaussian approximation, you make saddle point approximations, there are e to the power plus phi square terms, so you have to worry about the convergence of the integral, or you have to worry about the integration contour, etc., etc. There is no feeling about what the appropriate symmetries are at this point. Obviously, this thing has to satisfy certain symmetries, and in particular, it has to satisfy electromagnetic duality. And if this is the context when you have S duality invariance, then it should be consistent with S duality invariance, etc., etc. And that is not at all clear. I mean, so there must be some kind of measure here or modification. And there is also the issue of the holomorphic anomaly. And at this point, there are different ideas. There are arguments why you should do this completely holomorphically. That would, of course, be very nice. There are even ideas that you should only take the lowest order approximation and generate the whole set of generate everything you want to know. But from certain other arguments, you can derive that you should probably take into account the non-holomorphic corrections and in order to get sensible results. Anyway, these people conclude, and we agree with that conclusion, that that this proposal, the conjecture in this original form, definitely has to be modified. Now,
did you set the conclusion for disagreement between examples and the prediction?
Yes, yes. At some point they look at examples, and I'll say something about the modifications that that they make. For instance, when they calculate, also there is an earlier paper by Davolka in September. If you look at that paper, then you generate something which is just a separate function of the magnetic charges, which you then throw away because you say it's the measure. But that is some sort of worrisome because you're calculating this D of Q and P, and then you find something here which where you seem to need a function which of the charges, and so in some sense you're reducing your predictive power of the formula. You don't want that. You want to have this in closed form. So to resolve some of these differences and realizing that we have this variational principle, which goes back all the way in its unreduced form, where you do not impose any of the tractor equations, you could say, well, let's look at this. Let's take the degeneracies and write it as an integral now over the y and the y bar. So we have twice as many integration variables. And then we take the complete sigma without imposing any of the tractor equations. Then if we do a several-point approximation, since I didn't show you, it's on another transparency, what the sigma is, but if you do a several-point approximation there around the magnetic attractor equations, the attractor points, then you find that you find precisely this integral back. Okay, so let me say that again. So if you integrate here over the imaginary part of the y's, so that you're left only with the real part of the y's, that means that you impose the magnetic equations, and if you do stationary and then a settle point approximation here, that is exactly what you get. Now at this point I ignore the choice of the integration contours, because that problem remains. You know, I do Gaussian integrals and I sort of close my eyes for whatever the sign is and whether it converges or not. I just do it. And I also don't worry about possible non-holomorphic corrections. I sort of write this formula and I simply look at the generic terms in the holomorphic setting. So what I'm suggesting is that this thing, in some sense, is equivalent to that thing. Not precisely, of course, because it's only equivalent when you do a saddle point approximation. And if I do the full saddle point approximation, that means that if I do this once more, if I integrate over phi, then I get the stabilization equations and I get the macroscopic entropy that I had originally. Does this mean something, Vijay? Okay. I get the stabilization equations and the macroscopic entropy. So this thing sort of ties up with what I should expect in some sort of semi-classical approximation. Okay, and they seem to be nicely related. You can either start with the original integral, you can go halfway, pose the magnetic attractor equations, which then sort of a settle point approximation of the original form, and then you can go on, and then you get the macroscopic form I meant attractor equations. However, the equation, the integral that I wrote down here, I was just as naive as everybody else. I simply wrote down y and y bar. But who tells me that there is not a measure, and what is the behavior under certain symmetry translation? And in this case, when I'm assuming that everything is holomorphic, then I know that that is wrong, that that doesn't make any sense, because I know that the result that I have should at least be consistent with electric-magnetic duality. That means that the measure should be symplectically covariant or invariant or something. Now, if you remember that to repair the damage here, to correct this, the variation of sigma was proportional to the variations of the real part of F and the real part Fi and the real part of the Ys. So why not choose real integration variables which have these, well, which are precisely the same things here? And that makes a lot of sense because the Fi's and the Yi's are related by electric magnetic duality. So I know exactly how they transform. So when I take this measure here, with these real variables now, then I get a determinant of 2 times the imaginary part of the second derivative of f times the dy dy bar. But this thing here is symplectically invariant because it's built from the period vectors and they rotate just with symplectically with a linear transformation, constant linear transformation, with determinant 1. So this is the proposal is that this is symplectically invariant measure, which is really the measure you should put in. It's the only thing that makes sense. Now, if you do that, then integrating out the imaginary part, so to go to the Ogura-Stromitzer-Waffa situation, then, of course, you remove part of the determinant, and you're left with the square root. If you assume that the determinant is itself slowly varying. In principle, you will also get derivatives of the determinant that you have to worry about, but let's be very optimistic at the moment. Let's assume that these derivatives are not very crucial in this case.
Normalization of the measurement we take previously,
there is
a 1 behind the
determinant. You mean whether there's a constant there?
Yes.
Yeah, there could be a constant there. Yes.
But you're proposing the constant is 1?
No. That's why there is not an equal sign. So if you do the first integral, then you get this. So this is, and since this thing here was precisely the same function that you have for Ogura-Stromitzer-Waffa, that means that you have now the measure in this case, although it's an approximation because it's by saddle point methods and making an assumption about the determinant. And if you do then the final integral again, and you make the same assumption, you get the macroscopic entropy. So there seems to be a chain of variational principles and saddle point approximations, which sort of brings everything brings it into place. Now, you may say, well, you're quite optimistic because you're putting in this determinant here, and my goodness, that's going to be a mess. And of course, it is a mess when you try to put it in. But we know one example where this is working exactly like that. And that's not in the electric case, because the electric case is still a mystery, but it is in the dionic case. Namely, in the dionic case, when we took the quarter BPS states, and we did a saddle point approximation on the DVV formula, then we also found something which was e to the power, say, the action, or the thing that is going to be the entropy, with the corresponding equations which would lead to the attractor equation. But then there was another thing which actually came in this case from a residue, but it was a little bit like a measure, and that measure, the value of the measure at the attractor point was such that it precisely cancelled the determinant that you got from the saddle point approximation. But the result was not correct because it was correct only up to terms proportional to the derivatives of this particular term. But the derivatives of this term were all zero, or at least they vanished in the limit that the charges were large. So in other words, you needed this determinant. It was crucial because it had to cancel, it had to absorb the determinant that you got from the integration in the saddle point methods, but you didn't want the derivatives, and the large charge limit in that particular case was precisely such that you had this situation, that it was like you could treat this term like a constant. So it may seem that we are optimistic, but we have one particular example where things work exactly like that. Now, I'm not implying here that this formula here that we are working out, that we are proposing, will lead at the end to the Dijkgraaf-Verlinde-Verlinde formula, because we did a comparison and we saw that the actual formula was still quite different. It's very hard to interpret, although we saw that at the saddle point, things are coinciding and the comparison makes sense. Now, the proposal that we have here goes beyond the modifications suggested by Dabolkar et al., who make the following changes. First of all, they introduce a prefactor, and the prefactor depends on the magnetic charges. And already expressed this, you know, this is not a very good thing because you're trying to calculate the function of the P's and the Q's, and then you have an expression for it which is supposed to give that expression for you, but then you say, well, you know, it's only up to some function of the P's. That's not going in the right direction. And the other thing is that they modify the topological partition function with something which could have something to do with the determinants, with the measure that we are discussing here. This is something we don't know yet. But remember, this is in the electric case, right? And everything in the electric case is more complicated. And at least the proposal that we have, we know how it works in the dionic case. So let's go back at the end now to the electric case and see why it is so hard. And then we notice the number of things which are crucial in the electric case. First of all, the determinant of this measure that we had was equal to zero. You see, I chose these real coordinates, and I was, of course, assuming that generically they would be independent coordinates. But in this particular case, apparently they are not independent coordinates, at least not when you suppress the non-perturbative terms which go like e to the power minus 2 pi s. And very strangely, I thought, well, then we will just introduce the holomorphic terms in it, because we can also do it, the non-holomorphic corrections. We can also do it non-holomorphically. And lo and behold, also with the non-holomorphic terms, this determinant is equal to zero. But then you realize that if that determinant is equal to zero, then it means that the integral must blow up, because it means that there is some coordinate on which this thing, some integration variable on which this thing doesn't depend. So in some sense, this is not a disaster. It only means that we cannot calculate it. You see, the integral goes to infinity, and the measure that multiplies it goes to zero. So we have a zero over zero problem, and we cannot evaluate it, but it's not that something, well, if you're lucky, then we may still be able to get a sensible result once we know how to regularize that. So it is this feature which makes the 1/2 DPS case so qualitatively different from the quarter BPS situation. And that's why it is so hard to come to a resolution of these difficulties. Now, Dabolkar et al. Also realized this, and they regulated divergent at least, because they also see that the thing doesn't depend on all the integration variables, by taking an integration contour where the imaginary part is restricted to a finite interval, which is, of course, very sensible when you have S-duality invariance. But they insist that you do it holomorphically. And in order to have S-duality invariance, you need the non-holomorphic terms. So we seem to be all on a sort of a closed circle where something has to go, something has to happen, and it's not quite clear what has to go. But I do think that this measure that we have is probably the right measure in this case to pursue, although we don't know whether you have to incorporate the holomorphic correction or not, or what the end of the story is. So this is my conclusion. Thank you.